Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Monday, April 22nd. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Tonight is the first night of Passover, when Jews around the world will gather with loved ones for a ceremonial meal and a retelling of and discussion around the Exodus story of God freeing people known as the Israelites from slavery in ancient Egypt and leading them to the promised land, Canaan, more or less what later came to be known as Israel and Palestine. Passover this year comes obviously at a fraught time for many Jews, Jewish Americans, Jewish families, just a half year out from October 7th, the deadliest day for attacks on Jews since the Holocaust, with many hostages from that day, don't forget, still being held, and also with intergenerational and other family conflict, or at least disagreement, likely to arise around the Passover table about the war in Gaza, and even fundamentally how to think about their relationship to that ancient promised land in modern times. And as if that's not enough, Passover also comes with anti-Semitism on the rise, leaving many Jews less secure in their place in society and in their physical safety, even in this country. Just over this past weekend, as you've heard reported, to take the big example in the news today, Jewish students at Columbia University disagreed with each other over how much danger an ongoing pro-Palestinian protest puts them in. The headline on this in the New York Times today reads, "As protests continue at Columbia, some Jewish students feel targeted." The article then starts by saying, "After reports of harassment by demonstrators, some Jewish students said they felt unsafe. Others rejected that view," the article says, "while condemning anti-Semitism." And other news organizations also note that one prominent rabbi affiliated with Columbia advised Jewish students to go home for the rest of the semester for their safety. To this moment and to these conversations comes an ambitious new book from Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman called To Be a Jew Today, A New Guide to God, Israel, and the Jewish People. This was in the works for years and largely written before October 7th, but it does take the changed world of today very much into account, as Noah does explicitly in related articles, too, in the last few weeks, such as a Washington Post op-ed called How October 7th is Forcing Jews to Reckon with Israel, and a Time magazine essay that he wrote called The New Anti-Semitism. Noah Feldman is the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard, where he is also founding director of the Julius Rabinowitz Program on Jewish and Israeli Law, and he is the author of numerous previous books, including The Broken Constitution, Divided by God, and The Rise and Fall of the Islamic State. Noah, thank you for joining us. A happy Passover to you and yours in advance, and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's always a pleasure to be with you, even if today's circumstances are a little more challenging than we might have hoped for.
Indeed. And why had you been writing a book that asks how to be a Jew today before October 7th?
You know, the title To Be a Jew Today implies the other possibility, which is to not be a Jew today. You know, to be implies the possibility of not to be. And I was really thinking about it intensely over the last few years as my kids got to the age where they were going to be applying to college and heading off to college. And it was very striking to me how different the environment was going to be for them on campus around being Jewish than it was for me, you know, 30 some years ago. And that's really what got me thinking about this. I really wanted to think about how Jewish identity, Jewish experience, and Jewish practice have changed. And I wanted to think about the affirmative case for why someone should be a Jew if they choose to be. And I wanted that affirmative case to go beyond, well, there are people who hate us, and so therefore we have no choice but to be Jewish. Because at least for me, it's not a good reason to be anything of identity simply that someone hates you. I mean, you have to deal with that. That's part of reality if you adopt that identity. But I don't think that's a good reason to go out and identify and be a Jew in the fullest sense. And so I wanted to explore the reasons that people have for being Jewish that are positive and affirmative.
And how much did the events of the last 6.5 months cause you to revise the book or change any of your basic premises?
I didn't change any of the central argument, which, to say it in just a nutshell, is that the best way to think about Jews today is as a very large, loving, and somewhat dysfunctional family. And I can say more about what that, what consequences that has. So that central argument remained the same. What I had to do was edit to bring home sort of two points. One, how much intergenerational trauma affects Jewish experience, really for all Jews. And that is to say, when we see the events of October 7 or the Israeli response in the Gaza war, or even events like, you know, you were just speaking about in your news report that are happening on some university campuses, it's very hard for Jews to experience these things just as the events themselves. They're experienced through the lens of the Holocaust, the lens of pogroms, and the lens of many, many centuries of Jewish oppression. And that's a perspective that needs to be really very much taken into account in understanding how people are feeling and what's going on.
Right.
And then the other element that was just that...
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say the other element that I really needed to emphasize was that people have very different kinds of perspectives on being Jewish and on Israel, but it's pretty hard for them to avoid engaging with Israel one way or the other, whether it's positive or it's negative. It's very hard for most Jews just to say, well, I'm just not going to focus on the Israel issue at all.
So you name the names of major Jewish denominations or rough categories these days: Reform, Conservative, Modern Orthodox, Ultra Orthodox, Reconstructionist, Humanist, Humanist Jews, who are those who don't believe in God but still value being Jewish. What would you say in 2024 are some underlying commonalities, Noah, if you identify any, that make people from any of those groups feel Jewish?
I think the essence of what it is to be a Jew today across all of those very varied worldviews is a sense of struggling together as a Jewish family with God, whether you believe in God or not, with what God wants from you, with respect to the right way to live. And again, that could just be a spiritual impulse or a moral impulse as well, with how to live in community with other people and with how to live as Jews. And I think that struggle idea, that collective struggle that also includes familial love, derives from the basic idea that family is where we usually get our very first experiences of love, our archetypal experiences of love. And family is also where we usually get our archetypal experiences of struggle. They go together. And the love of God for Israel in the Bible, and the love that Jews have for each other, and the love that Jews are commanded to have for God and for the stranger, to my mind, are all versions of that kind of love struggle. And of course, the details differ from movement to movement. But I think everyone who thinks of himself or herself as a Jew is having some version of that experience of love and struggle.
And maybe this is even where we enter with Israel, because you describe the early Zionists as actually trying to make a Jewish state not about religion, but religion kind of moving back in over time to a central position. Can you talk about that evolution as you see it?
Yes, the early Zionists were almost all secular and radically secular. And what they wanted to do was basically replace Judaism as a religion and as an ethnicity with Israeliness as a nation state. And their theory was that that would sort of solve all the problems that the Jews had experienced both internally and externally, because then Jews would just be like Italians or Irish or Koreans, I suppose, you know, anyone else whose identity was strictly national. Then they might have a religion attached, but for the most part, they were defined by their ethnicity. And that didn't work out exactly in that way. I mean, they did create a state and they did create a national identity of Israeliness. There is a national identity of being Israeli with its own culture and language and so forth. But it turns out some Israelis are not Jews, and many, many Jews, well over half of the Jews in the world, are clearly not Israelis. So the Jews aren't a single nation. Instead, what happened is that gradually and slowly, from a beginning where lots of Jews were not very invested in Israel, whether they were Reform Jews or ultra-Orthodox Jews, for different reasons, they were very uninvested in Israel. Over time, more and more Jews have come to see their identity, including Jews outside of Israel, as bound up in the nationalist project that is Israel and is Zionism. And that's all well and good, provided that for you as a Jew, your conception of Israel fits your conception of your religion. It doesn't work as well if, let's say, you have a progressive view of your Judaism. You believe that Judaism is social justice, the repairing of the world, the prophetic vision of clothing the naked and feeding the hungry. And then you look at Israel and you don't see a match between your social justice values, which for you are Jewish, and what the state of Israel is doing. Then it can create a genuine conflict where one might feel that one needs to criticize Israel rather than identifying with Israel in order to express one's Jewishness fully. And of course, the same is true on the other side too. There are people who see Israel as fundamentally definitional of their Jewishness. So what it is to be Jewish for them just is to be in support of Israel.
And some of your book is personal, about your own discussions with your own adult or college-age children. Want to tell your own story a little?
Sure. I do try to be personal in the book. I grew up in a modern Orthodox house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and our Seders were very, very late-going and always very, very intense, usually less about politics than about other aspects of Jewishness, but still, I remember very often, you know, reading the story of the four sons and thinking, man, I'm definitely the bad son here. And I think other people at the table sometimes thought so too. And then at various times, my brothers got to play that role as well. So in my own life, you know, with my own family, with my own kids, I'm acutely aware that for them, choosing to be Jewish is a choice. You know, they could do it or they could not do it. And I try to show them what's good about Judaism. And it's still hard. You know, they both came with me on trips to Israel at various times. And my son in particular saw, you know, the barrier, the wall separating Israel and Palestine. And with both of my kids, we also went into the Palestinian areas. And it made a very, very big impression. And I think it got him thinking very deeply about, you know, the problems with the current situation between Israel and Palestinians. And so that's very much a live issue in our family and in our discussions, unquestionably.
And before we take a break and then start folding the callers in, I want you to be able to touch on your Time magazine article, The New Anti-Semitism. For one thing, you write that the old anti-Semitism, whether from medieval Christian crusaders or 20th century Nazis, was willing to proclaim itself, while today no one wants to be seen as anti-Semitic. What changed?
There is a really big change. I mean, okay, somewhere at the far right periphery and maybe the far left periphery, maybe there are some people who would say, we just hate the Jews. And, you know, occasionally one does, you know, hear that, you know, including chanted on the streets. But I think that's the periphery. I think the great majority of people today want to say, well, I'm not anti-Semitic, but I am anti-Zionist, or I am very, very critical of Israel. And here's where it gets subtle. And this is what I tried to say in the article. It's totally legitimate to criticize Israel, and you can do so without being an anti-Semite. You can have the most searing critiques of Israel without that turning you into an anti-Semite. And it's also true that at the periphery of the argument that, you know, Israel is fundamentally an unjust state, one could easily veer into anti-Semitism, for example, by depicting all Jews in general or all Israelis as inherently oppressors, or Israel as a white supremacist society, forgetting that Israel is a country founded by people who were themselves deeply traumatized by the experience of victimhood, and trying to sort of shift the game so that instead of Jews being seen as oppressed people who may or may not be getting it right today, one thinks of all Jews as inherently powerful and inherently oppressors. And that starts to become reminiscent of the bad old anti-Semitism, where the anti-Semite would look at an oppressed Jew in the corner and say, you see that guy? That guy really controls the world. You know, that's the kind of the bad old anti-Semitism. And I think that there's a real danger and risk of that. And I think sometimes that's happening in some of the protests that we're seeing now. Not always, but sometimes it is happening, that at the periphery of criticism of Israel, one can veer into a very worrisome and serious anti-Semitism.
And controversially, I imagine, though you certainly acknowledge the persistence of anti-Semitism on the far right, as you label it, you write that the most pernicious creative current in contemporary anti-Semitic thought is on the left. What is that current as you see it? And do you think you've been seeing that at Columbia this weekend, if you've been paying attention to that story?
The current is the idea that all Jews, no matter where they are automatically oppressors, that the status of being Jewish is a status of oppressing others, and that in consequence, the narrative of Israel should be read through the narrative of Jewish oppression of other people. I think that's the form of anti-Semitism that can emerge from criticisms of Israel that otherwise on their substance could be perfectly legitimate.
So, for example, one thing I read in one press report, and, you know, I think we know from our listeners' reactions and from other things, you can't trust any press report 100% on, you know, these high conflict situations. But one press report I saw had somebody yelling at somebody who appeared to be a Jewish student, calling that student a colonizer.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there's a pretty, that's pretty close to the heartland of what I'm describing. I mean, there's a Jewish student walking through campus, not presumably an Israeli, although maybe supporting Israel. And to call that person a colonizer is to imply that just because that person is Jewish or has identified as Jewish, that they're engaged in an act of wrongful oppression. That's different than taking the view in a measured conversation that the best way to understand Israel is to understand it through the lens of settler colonialism. Now, I happen to not agree with that point of view, but I don't think that that point of view is inherently an anti-Semitic one. But it can, as you gave in that example, cross into anti-Semitism. Another thing, and look, I'm not on the Columbia campus. I'm on a different campus, but I was watching, like a lot of people, the videos on Twitter. And again, even those need to be always taken with a grain of salt. But I could hear some protesters chanting or yelling at Jews, "Go back to Poland." That to me is another instance of flat and nasty and repugnant anti-Semitism, because these are just Jews walking down the street in New York. And, you know, had their ancestors been in Poland at the time of the Second World War, they would have been murdered by the Nazis when they invaded Poland. So to say "go back to Poland" is, you know, it's the opposite of, you know, it's the opposite of the acknowledgement of the humanity of the person that you're talking to, and it's as anti-Semitic as you can be.
Zeke in Boston, you're on WNYC with Noah Feldman. Hello, Zeke.
Hey, Brian, how are you? Thanks for the segment. Thanks for your show. You know, I love Passover. It's my favorite Jewish holiday. And this year, I won't be attending for the first time in my life the family Seder. And it's not out of protest. I'm not trying to send a message to my family or anyone else, really. It was just a personal decision for me. I couldn't stand the thought of sitting down and having what eventually becomes a feast, a celebratory feast, while Gazans were starving. And I guess I would just say on top of that, the hypocrisy to me of, it feels like hypocrisy to me to be reciting the story of the Exodus, which is all about the oppression of a people by a more powerful people. I feel that this year, you know, the oppressors are, you could say, the Israelis, but unfortunately, they are Jews, and it just doesn't sit right with me, and I didn't feel that I could personally do it.
Zeke, thank you very much. Different point of view in relationship to what's going to happen tonight, I think, from Lisa in Levittown. Lisa, thank you very much for calling. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Can you hear me okay?
Just fine. Thank you.
Great. Great to call in. I'm feeling that it's a very difficult time for Jews right now with the, you know, exploding anti-Semitism in this country and also the events in Israel. And I'm so deeply appreciative of discussions like the one you're having with Professor Feldman. I think we really need it. I'm progressive, a New York Jewish person, skewing more towards social justice than I would say towards religiosity. And I feel that it's very important right now for Jews not to be afraid and to speak to one another and to reflect on our Judaism in this way. And to answer your question about what we're going to do tonight is to leave empty chairs at the table to remember those Jews who are currently captive in Gaza, and for the Jews in Israel who may be living in fear. If this is a celebration about liberation and being released, then I think that's really what is rising to our thoughts at this time.
And what if somebody at your table were to raise the thought that the previous caller just raised, that how can we have what is ultimately a celebration when 30,000+ people have been killed in Gaza, in addition to obviously the suffering of the hostages, and starvation is going on in Gaza as a side effect of the war, too. What would you say to that person if there is such a person at your table?
Great question. And these are such complex and complicated times. I think Tikkun Olam, we're in this world to try and unite. I try to hold space for both the bad and good we see around us. I think we have to also be willing to see the good and to do what we can personally and globally to try and bring people together. It's the most complicated times. I'm a boomer, and I just can't remember times that have been this complex.
Lisa, thank you very much for your call, and thanks to all of you who called with a variety of perspectives on what Seder or non-participation in Seder is going to be like for you tonight. And Noah, in our last minute or so, you can reflect on that last set of calls. But also she mentioned the concept of Tikkun Olam, which I know you frame some of your writing around as pertains to multiple generations of Jews who consider themselves progressive. So maybe you want to reflect on that in our last minute or so, and anything else you want to say.
Sure. Yes, Tikkun Olam, which literally means to repair the world, is an idea that is at the core of Jewish social justice. It's also a mystical idea. It's also the idea that the world is fundamentally broken and that humans have a role to play in bringing the world, and including the world God, back to its proper state. And I think, you know, when Zeke called us, I'm glad that he did that. Maybe that's Zeke Seder. And that was very, very Jewish response on his part. And similarly for Lisa, thinking about the pain at the Seder of Jews who are still Israelis, who are still kidnapped and are hostages in Gaza. So there's sadness intermixed with joy, and there's struggle intermixed with love. And to me, that's what Passover is about, because that's what archetypally being a Jew is going to be about. So, you know, the Passover story isn't all smiles. It acknowledges the pain of the Israelites enslaved. It acknowledges also the suffering of people who were harmed in the process of the liberation of the Israelites, including the Egyptians, you know, for whom God also shows compassion. So that's the complexity of it. And I hope for people who are having Passover this evening that they're able to appreciate their familial love and connection in the midst of that complexity.
Noah Feldman, Harvard Law professor, is now the author of To Be a Jew Today, A New Guide to God, Israel, and the Jewish People. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us and talking to callers. Happy Passover to you and your family, Noah.
Thank you, and to you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.